everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, we have a different co-host from Quarter to Three, Jason McMaster.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, we were all set to have a big talk, but fortunately Ken had to go away, and we basically went through our contacts, and it's just going to be the two of us today.
Yeah. That's okay, though.
Mm-hmm.
We're interesting people. We don't need Hopefully. Kim.
Yeah. All right. So, the piece that I want to talk about for game news is a basically recent brouhaha for the indie game Kerbal Space Program.
Right.
Now, have you played it, Jason?
I have not. I've seen like a little bit about it, but I have not played it.
Yeah, me neither. I missed out on like the big Kickstarter. I've been just looking at it, wanting to pick it up, but money is still tight, so I haven't really had a chance. So, for those of you who are in the same boat, Kerbal Space Program, from what we've been reading and watching online, is a sandbox-ish type game where you basically run a spaceship program. You basically design the ships, you design, you know, how they're going to react, the equipment they use, even the astronauts. And it's basically about trying to get a spaceship successfully outside of the atmosphere. And then I've heard that you can go further and try to land on, like, the moon or search alien planets. And, of course, you have to bring the people back. So there's this whole big community about modding it and about how it's, I think it's been in like development for at least a few years at this point. Do you know when it first started?
I do not.
Yeah. So they've been going the route of they release free content as they're still in beta. You can, of course, buy the game at any point and then you have it from that point forward. And I believe it's recently been put onto Steam's early their alpha program. I forget the official title for that now.
And, the Steam stuff? Greenlight, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought, do they have like a second name for like their pre-release alpha? Like, or are they still just using that for Greenlight?
I think it's just Greenlight. I'm not familiar.
Alright. So, the argument that happened this week was that they were announcing about how they've been developing all kinds of new stuff for the game, and how the more, of course, they want to develop, the more that it's going to delay the final product. So the plan that the lead designer said was they were going to take a lot of their newer content or stuff that they're going to develop and basically release it after the game would be launched as DLC or as expansions. So the argument came and the fact that when for all this time, they've been promoting Kerbal as a game where if you pre-order it now, you basically get all content or all features free, you know, for as long as the game's in development. Similar to what Notch did with Minecraft, that at any point, whenever you bought the game, you would basically get whatever else they would add to it from that point forward at no additional cost.
Right.
So it definitely leads to a bit of a argument over, I guess, the issues of entitlement versus, like how they were entitlement versus promotion. Because if you look at their site and what they've talked about, they said that anything new they would add would be considered free.
Right.
And so it definitely leads to that like that murky gray area, especially what we've been seeing with a lot of crowdfunding. Because one of the things we've talked that I know we've talked about on our podcast a few times is the Kickstarter entitlement. Like, if the developers decide to do something else or they change their minds, you know, halfway during their development, the guys who fund that Kickstarter are basically, you know, they're pulled along by a leash. They have no way to control it.
Right.
Now, in terms of the Kerbal Space Program story, they basically backpedaled on that, and now they're saying that they're going to release a new DLC as free for those who bought it. So, what do you think, Jason, about this? Do you think that they were wrong in declaring that, or do you think it's just a case of the fans being a little too overzealous about it?
Well, I would think that they don't... If it's like a full expansion, I would think it doesn't have to be included in the purchase price of the Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, they promised you a game. They didn't promise you a game, like, every year for the rest of your life. So...
Yeah,
I don't know. It's kind of a weird place. Yeah. And there's no real rules for Kickstarter. Like, not much, really, you know? I mean, there is, but, like, there's no real guarantee.
Yep.
Yeah,
especially, well, I know, like, a few weeks ago, people were arguing about the issue with stretch goals. Like, should a company, are you required to have stretch goals or not? And some people said that stretch goals, you know, are a big deal, while others say they seem more, you know, like as developers trying, you know, stretch the Kickstarter out or basically keep features, you know, as hostage for the consumer.
Hey, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a sticky situation, but it's one that doesn't really have an easy answer. But I would think, yeah, you can't expect them to just, like, make sequels and expansions to the game and just hand them to you.
Yeah, and I think it's also a difference if we compare this to Minecraft. It seems that Kerbal Space Program has a lot more content than Minecraft did. Now, although I honestly haven't played Minecraft in at least a year or two, so I don't know all the craziness that has been added to it since. But if what they're talking about for Kerbal and how they're going to add, you know, more modes, more features and all that, that seems like a sizable amount of content that they're basically giving away for free.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it just really comes down to whether or not the company feels that they should deliver it in the end. But beyond whatever they've promised is just kind of like cake, I would say. So.
Mm-hmm. And also raise the point, like, if they do decide... Like, how is this going to affect their future plans? Are they going to say, oh, it's free, but we're going to make Kerbal Space Program 2 or 3? So, I mean, and I think, on one hand, it's going to allow them to earn money, but I think if they go that route, it's going to be viewed by a lot of people as being very, you know, shady if they do that.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, and that's, like, the sticky part of Kickstarters. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can be a very, very good thing, but at the same time, you'd have to watch out for feature creep, and it just kind of depends on, like, on really what they end up delivering in the end. I mean, there's really nothing you can say about it for now, but I think people are overreacting to a concept is what it really comes down to.
Yeah. Let's see if there's anything else about them. Yeah, so, I mean, the game has been in development for so long. Now, were they actually a Kickstarter? That's because I don't remember. Let me do a quick check here. Little space for
I thought they were.
I'm not seeing it on Kickstarter, but they have changed their search feature. But, yeah, so... And this is sort of similar to a few weeks ago with the Banner Saga, with the issue when they basically said at the very beginning that they were going to create a free-to-play online game, which the content would basically be fed into the single player. And a lot of people were complaining because they felt that, you know, they took their money and tried to create something else, you know, separate.
Right.
But in that case, they basically said in the actual Kickstarter video, hey, that's what we're going to do. And I think there is an issue that sometimes fans, they don't see it. Like when they talk about Kama Sutra, I mean, the guy basically didn't even read the update emails. So it's really hard to sympathize with the fans like that when you're kind of expecting them to know more about it than you do, but they don't.
Right. Well, okay, so looking at the Kerbal thing, if it's not a Kickstarter, which I guess I was just confused, I thought you had said it was or something for some reason.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was either Kickstarting or it was just like an alpha state, sort of like Prison Architect.
Yeah, I think it's an alpha state. And really, the game says you get, you have the game in its current state and for all future updates. I mean, I guess it's kind of vague, but if you really think it's going to be like all the expansions instead of like patches and you know, like bug fixes to the game, I don't know. It seems like it's being a bit obtuse.
Yeah, I think that's another issue we're seeing, because with the whole, as you said, with crowdfunding still so relatively new, a lot of people really don't know, you know, the proper ways of doing it. And I think one of the areas is you have to be, you know, iron law clear on, you know, exactly what your money will get you, what's promised, and that's it. I think that would have basically eased a lot of headaches over this issue.
Yes.
All right. So, let's move on. What news do you have, Jason?
You know, this week was kind of interesting for Microsoft. They,
yeah.
A lot of stuff has been leaked, like, over the past few months. But recently it came out that it would be always on, like an always connected, all the time kind of situation. And in response to that, one of the guys that works, a creative director at Microsoft Studios, got into like a Twitter tirade with several people. And, well, I'll just let him speak for himself. Adam Orth says, "Sorry, I don't get the drama about having an always-on console. Every device now is always on. That's the world we live in." Which I agree with him there. I actually don't. I kind of... Now, I'll say that I agree, but I do think that if you're, like, not connected to the internet, you should be still able to play your games and stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, whatever. But we are always on all the time. Or most people are.
Yeah.
And someone replies to him and says, "Did you learn nothing from Diablo 3 or SimCity? You know some people's internet goes out, right? Deal with it is a shitty reason." And I kind of agree with him there, too. Because the guy really shouldn't be saying anything.
Yeah, but I'm willing to I'm going to talk more about that in length later on in the cast, too, because I think that's an interesting topic.
But yeah, and Orth replies with, "Electricity goes out, too." And it's a completely, like, ridiculous statement. And here's where he really, really takes it to the limit, which I'm very fond of this one, is the guy, Manvir Hare, maybe? Hare? "You've lived in L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, a very connected place. Try living in Janesville, Wisconsin, or Blacksburg, Virginia." And Adam Orth replies was, "Why on earth would I live there?"
Lovely.
Yeah, yeah, so winning of hearts and minds. He has since quieted down quite a bit, so I'm sure there were some people at Microsoft that had a talk with him.
Yeah, I think he resigned today, or the other day. He was actually let go.
Good. Well, he needs to keep his mouth shut. It's ridiculous. However, he has a point that always on is pretty much the standard if you think about it. I mean, for the average person that's going to own a new Xbox, like our cell phones are always connected. Everything, you know, a large portion of our electronics are always on. So it's really, I don't think it's that big of a deal. The only thing that could be a monkey wrench for them, though, is the digital, like, copyright protection stuff of making sure that you have a legal copy via an internet connection. And if you do not, you cannot play it. That will totally be a big problem.
Yeah. And there's definitely going to be an issue with the used game market. I know that GameStop has been hurting really bad this generation. I think, did they, like, announce, like, what was, like, a several, like, million-dollar loss this year, so, or in 2012? Because the used game market, at least for PC-wise, has all but disappeared thanks to digital distribution. And console-wise, it's slowly getting there. Like, we're seeing, like, with the PlayStation Network, you can basically buy Vita games, buy some of the PlayStation 3 games, I believe, as well. So we're definitely getting there. I think, like, the only guys who haven't fully committed to it has been Nintendo. But I don't know if they've actually, you know, starting to learn at this point how important online is.
Oh, yeah. No, it's, Nintendo's actually come a long way. Very quickly, and they need to, or they're going to die. you know. Yeah. And that's kind of the way it's going. But and people are always going to find something to complain about. So the always on thing, yeah, it's, I don't know, it's a necessary evil. I mean, the days people started purchasing DLC packs and not expecting that as parts of games, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you can't complain about something while completely supporting something.
Yeah, that's true.
So, that's just kind of how the industry is going, unfortunately.
And I think it is going to be interesting to see how it's going to develop over the next generation. Because the PC has somewhat gotten there, but at the same time, Steam has made a number of concessions towards offline mode.
Yeah.
So they've been smart in that aspect. And we still haven't officially gotten the word about the PlayStation 4 yet. They've been keeping themselves pretty quiet, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they really haven't said much. I'm kind of interested to see what they do. They're going to have to do something this generation. They do not have the leverage that Microsoft does. Nobody's buying their electronics anymore. Samsung's taken a lot of the wind out of their sails.
And the Vita has been not doing that well. I haven't really heard anything much about it either.
Yeah, I really like my Vita, don't get me wrong. But it was almost a foolish release. Now, I can't say for sure that it was. Until we see what they do with the PS4, because I think they have mentioned that they're going to support it with a PS4, so I'm kind of curious to see what they do. But, I mean, odds are it's probably going to go down in history as a unsupported platform, unfortunately.
And it seems like the 3DS has picked up a lot over the last few months. And that started out not that well. There wasn't a lot of good releases, but we're seeing more and more games.
Oh, yeah.
But with the Vita, it just seems like, other than, you know, the cross-system connectivity, there hasn't been any, like, really big elements for it.
Yeah, I mean, one thing with the Vita that I think it really does have going for it, it has, like, quite a bit of PS2, PS3 kind of crossover games that it's getting, which you mentioned, but all of these are very, very easy to get via the PlayStation Store. So it's pretty cool way to deliver games, like with the 3DS as well. It's just genius that they're offering just about every new title, like day one in that store as well. It's just the way to go. And I think that has that going for it for the Vita, but it really is going to hinge on the PlayStation 4's performance and whether Sony abandons it or not, really. But they're going to have to attract a lot more developers to it. And, I mean, that's something Nintendo needs to work on as well, but the DS market is pretty strong still.
I guess there's one bit of irony with the whole Microsoft versus Sony, is that while Microsoft is pushing for always-on connectivity, Sony has done a reasonably good job with the PlayStation Network, I think. With Xbox Live, basically all you're getting is online multiplayer. But what they've been doing, from what I've seen, is they offer discounts on games. You get free games each month as long as you keep with the service. And the PlayStation 3 already, from this beginning, had free online multiplayer. So I think they've done a better job of getting people onto their service than Microsoft has.
Yeah, and you know, I think, and while I agree, I also think that Microsoft gets a kind of a bad rap. For that, now, I mean, I think that they bring some of that on themselves by increasing the price last year. But they do offer quite a good service. I mean, the matchmaking is pretty top notch. The voice quality is really high quality voice. They only just shoot themselves in the foot by putting so many ads on it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, as a gamer, it kind of bothers me when I turn on my Xbox 360 and the games like the actual game section of it, not the launch whatever's in your tray, but like the, you know, what's new and all that, is like three or four tabs away. It's just, it's very telling. And I know Microsoft's very interested in taking over the living room as well as just, you know, the PC market, which they're kind of having trouble with right now anyway. But, it's just really disheartening because, I like the Xbox as a game system, not as a media player.
And I remember, like, a few months ago or last year, there were articles about how indie developers have been complaining about that, that it's so hard to find indie games on Xbox Live.
Yeah.
And that just, and especially with the indie game market, I mean, if you don't get your game out there, you're practically screwed. And I think Steam has done such a better job at that. I mean, they allowed, you know, Binding of Isaac, a game that had, like, the whole concept of the game was about, you know, the problems of religion. When that game came out, it was, like, front page, first thing you saw when you loaded it up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, we've come a long way in game distribution, specifically. It's a pretty interesting world.
Yeah. And I want to talk more about this now, but that's basically the topic that we're going to talk about later in the podcast. So I've got, you know, all this, you know, building up for that part.
Sure, yeah.
All right. So let's move and talk about some of the games we've been playing. For those of you who have been reading the site this week, I've been in first-person shooter mode. I've played BioShock Infinite. And I've been going back through some of my favorite first-person shooters. And the one I was playing last night was Painkiller. Have you played Painkiller, Jason?
The original? Yeah.
Yeah.
Really good game.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the funny part is this was done by People Can Fly, who went on to do Bulletstorm.
Yeah.
Which, as a lot of people know, wasn't exactly a highly reviewed game.
I really liked it, personally. But yes, it did not do that well in the older reviews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like it too. And when I talked, but when I brought this up last week on the cast, both Ken and Evan basically said, "How do you like that game?" And so it's just so hard to get past a lot of the preconception of views on that. By the fact that the game basically starts with your guy drunk, a lot of like immature humor and whatnot.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there's there's a certain comedy to the absurdity of it, which I think a lot of people find very off-putting. But I think, like, gameplay on that was actually really strong. I think the problem that I have most is that I wish there had been a much stronger multiplayer mode, or I wish it had been, like, a true co-op mode, because I'm not really sure why there wasn't, like, a true co-op playthrough mode.
Yeah.
Because it seems like it'd be perfect for it. I don't know.
Yeah, that would have been very fun having dual leashes going about.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't. And, you know, it's like, it's not like they can't do it. You know, they obviously can. They proved that with their multiplayer mode. It just wasn't, I don't know. It was just kind of lost its appeal really quickly, I guess.
Yeah. Did you like the skill shot system that they had? Because I felt that it was good, but I don't think they took it far enough.
Oh, no, I absolutely agree. That's the first thing I think of, is that, like, I really enjoyed it, but it was very limited. You only got, like, a certain amount, and you had to basically get most of the interesting ones on a level to go through, or, like, to get a higher rating, and there just wasn't really that much wiggle room with it. You had to specifically go for, I'm going to impale this guy here, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. It was almost like a rehearsal thing instead of like a freestyle kind of thing. Because, you know, they had all these like setups too, like this traps and stuff you could do. Like you could leash that stuff on the ceiling, it would fall on people, etc., etc. But you really did, yeah, you didn't have any room to really play with it as much. You just had to kind of specifically focus on that task if you wanted to, like, get the most points out of that level. So, yeah, that kind of bugged me.
Yeah. And we talked about how it didn't have there was no co-op mode, which is when I think another game that did a really good claw mode, but no one played would have to be The Darkness 2, which we both played a few times, and I thought that was a really good co-op mode.
It really was. I wish that there had been more for it, but I think the game was not as well received as I think it really deserves.
Yeah, I think what hurt it was really the length. I mean, it was
short
as far as like shooters or just like real games. I think it was only like 3-4 hours long.
Right. Yeah. No, it really was, and I guess the whole point of it was to, I guess, to go back through and try on the Game Plus mode, but not a lot of people like to do that.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of new Game Plus either. It just seems that I'm just doing the same thing, but only harder. The only times that I've like somewhat enjoyed it are like in ARPGs, like Diablo, and those games where there's an actual reward for making the game harder like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And I guess a lot of people just kind of miss out on that, and it didn't have the strongest, but it did have, like you said, a really great co-op, really fascinating co-op, in fact.
Yeah, especially considering that each character was different in their powers, so you had like this great ability to combine the different powers at the same time, which you couldn't really do in the single player because you weren't limited that way.
Right, and everybody has, like, in the co-op mode, you have, like, everybody has like unique abilities, and they all do come together for some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. Going back to Painkiller, I think one thing that I saw that was really translated from Painkiller to Bulletstorm was the weapon variety, and I think that's one of those areas that it's somewhat low key in a lot of first person shooters, like just how great a decent weapon variety can make the game. And this was one of the issues I had with BioShock Infinite, that for such a unique world, the weapons themselves just seemed very generic.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, BioShock Infinite is kind of a strange bird to me. I know everybody's, like, going crazy over it, and I understand that, but and I love the story. I love the setting, but I'm not in love with the gameplay.
Yeah, me neither. And I basically wrote 2,000 words about that earlier this week.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, I liked the original BioShock better than this one. It just felt like there was a lot more, going on in it. And it's just, BioShock Infinite just, to me, so far feels like a linking corridor to a battle area. So far I'm not really all that impressed with all the different abilities you have. Like,
yeah.
I mean, they're cool, you know, but like, you know, in BioShock, when you took over one of those machine guns and hacked it and stuff, it stayed hacked, you know, and it was an interesting, you could lead people into it and you could do that. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, you possess things and whatever. So I don't know. It's just not that, it doesn't have the same appeal to me. However, the writing is excellent. It's an interesting concept, and I really like what's going on in it.
Yeah. And just the same thing. The gameplay just did not really click for me.
Yeah.
I played it on hard mode, and then I started going through it on the 1999 mode. And it definitely feels like a step back from the original BioShock.
Yeah.
As you said, it feels more like set piece. It doesn't feel like I'm in this world. It just feels I'm moving from one big room to another big room.
Yeah.
And like everything you do in the previous room, you know, just stays there. And I did like in the first one how you could set up these traps, you could lead these people to it. And I just thought there was just more you could do there than you can in BioShock Infinite.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's, I don't know, there's something about it, and it's like, I think the setting's awesome in Infinite. Other than, the weapons are kind of something else, but, like, the actual, I love the docking, like, different parts of the floating city, and, like, all the, you know, it's such a crazy game. Like, the writing is awesome, but it's just, it just doesn't, God, it's, you know, it's like playing an id game or something, which, I mean, it's kind of a, I'm so sorry, id, you know, but like, your games are just kind of boring.
Yeah.
Like, I loved them when I was, you know, 12 and 13. Wait, 12's a little early. Okay, 15. and stuff. And, hey, man, I played the hell out of Doom and stuff. But, like, there's been a long time, you know. Just shotguns and demons ain't going to do it anymore.
Yeah. And it just felt that, like, when I go back to play a game like Painkiller, like, there just seems like there's a lot more going on. The weapons have such a great feel to them. And that is just a very underrated aspect of, like, when you get that feeling of the gun right, like, when you use, like, a rocket launcher and just mows down, you know, entire small group of enemies,
yeah.
Or when you open up the door and there's, you know, 50 guys charging at you. I mean, there's definitely a thrill there. And the boss battles in Painkiller were also really great. Like, all of a sudden, you've been fighting these little guys, and then it's like a 50-foot tall, you know, giant with a hammer trying to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, Painkiller, man, Painkiller really, it was so visceral. It got that feeling down. And that's something that I think you can say for a lot of stuff, like, done by them and done by Epic, mm-hmm. and just the studios that work with Epic, is they seem to get, they have a really good sense of, like, the weight of things, for yeah. lack of a better term.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, whenever someone fires a shotgun in one of those games, it just has a serious feeling to it. And I don't know if it's all, like, partially sound design or partially, you know, animation, but there's just something really satisfying about it. So, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Let's move from Painkiller, then. And what game have you been playing, Jason?
You know, I've been playing a bunch of stuff. I think the last few days I've dedicated a good amount of time to, like, Etrian Odyssey 4. I've played a little Luigi's Mansion 2. Lego City Undercover. Few other things, but yeah, those have been my big things.
How is Luigi Mansion 2?
It's really good. I enjoy the just about every aspect of it's cool. If you like the first game, it's a no-brainer. It's actually much expanded upon.
Mm-hmm.
You go on different missions that open up different parts of haunted houses, etc. Cool. And there's, like, a lot of bonus item hunting, collecting, that sort of thing. The animation's excellent, sound design's excellent, the 3D is really cool. Whoever put that game together did a really great job. It's really addictive.
And the first one was considered, I remember when it first came out, a lot of people looked down on it, because they were like,
yeah.
What the hell is this game? This isn't Mario.
Yeah, no, it's, and one thing, too, is I think the original, Luigi's Mansion was kind of short,
mm-hmm.
So I think it got a lot of flack over that, but in general,
mm-hmm.
the game itself, I found it very charming. I personally like Luigi better. than Mario anyway, because I always like the little man. I like, you know, he's kind of the lovable loser, whereas, you know, mm-hmm. Mario's strong and determined. Luigi's like, hey, I don't know. So, you know, you gotta go, yeah, you gotta give him some love. But, yeah, the Luigi stuff is really fun. And it's great for kids, but there's also, like, a lot of stuff going on in it that certainly appeals to the OCD collector in us all. But yeah, no, the 3DS has been quite a fixture lately. I got one of the XL 3DSs in there. They're really great. I really love it. That and my Vita, both great handhelds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been playing on my 3DS. I've been going back to Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey. So I still haven't finished that game yet. I want to get through it at least once.
Yeah. Yeah. Those games are quite an epic undertaking, you know?
Yeah. And I haven't really beaten a lot of the Shin Megami Tensei games. I don't think I ever beat Persona 3. I did beat Persona 4.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever beat any of those games. And it's not like I didn't put any time into them. It's just one of those things where it's like after a certain amount of time, something shiny comes along and distracts me, and I chase after it. But yeah, those games are such huge time sinks, you know. And Etrian Odyssey is like that as well.
Yeah. How are you finding it, by the way?
Oh, I like it quite a bit. 3D is also really cool in it, but it just has such a certain appeal to it. Like it's almost like a less hardcore Monster Hunter. Because I like Monster Hunter quite a bit, but there's just like you have to put so much time into it that it's always going to be one of those games that I like buy and I play around with, but I never become hardcore in it. Like I always like I'm kind of jealous of the people that get totally into it. Like until I was a big fan of Dwarf Fortress and it was like kind of intimidating to me. I felt the same way about that, but it's anything that people are very passionate about. I guess I'm a little bit jealous of, and I always wished I was better at the Monster Hunter games. But with Etrian Odyssey, you know, it's very much like an old Bard's Tale, wizardry kind of first person dungeon thing where you scoot around. But they've added like a lot of overworld stuff to it, and. Just having a bunch of different classes to play with and switch out, and you know, you have to draw your own map in those games, so that's kind of fun because like it gives you on the 3DS, you get like a little grid at the bottom, like graph paper, and sorry, I don't know, it's a certain old school appeal with some pretty cool recent technology.
Yeah, Now, did you play the previous one, Etrian Odyssey 3?
I did not play 3, no. I think I played one of the earlier ones, though. I think I played 2, maybe that's one.
I still think that 3 is a little bit better than 4, just because there's a lot more class variety.
Yeah.
I don't think they really went as far with Etrian Odyssey 4, but then again, they did completely redesign the class progression with 4, so they kind of started over again.
Right. You know, the thing is, I haven't played tons of it yet, so I find it a little hard to comment on it overall, but I am kind of interested in what they're doing with it. Like, I really want to get more Street Pass and stuff, but I don't think that's going to happen for me. But I like the overall concept and character development, but
Going back to what you said a few minutes ago regarding, you know, looking at games like the fans who are really passionate about it.
Yeah.
For me, the series that sort of resonates with me about that is the Crusader Kings series by Paradox. Like, looking from the outside in, like, there's like a lot of enjoyment. I see people talking about, you know, all the different ways you can play the game, all the strategies. But when I try to sit down and play that game, I just, you know, my mind just goes blank trying to figure out, you know, how this interface works.
Yeah.
And, like, the tutorials, like, did nothing. And, like, when you have to turn to, you know, like, a YouTube video to watch, like, a 4-hour tutorial, you know your game's a little bit hard to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
Yeah. And I like to say... Yep.
That's kind of, like, why I get jealous of people with that kind of thing. It's like... I'm jealous of the desire, you know, the passion that gets put into learning to play certain games.
Going back with Dominions and Crusader Kings 2, I mean, these series have just such a hardcore fan base that, like, on one hand, that's really great. But on the other hand, I think it sort of makes the developers a little blind to the new guy. There's just, like, nothing... Like, especially with Dominions, there's, like, nothing in that game that tries to remotely teach you how to play it.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. I mean, don't get me wrong. Dwarf Fortress is absolutely the kind of game that does not teach you how to play it. I mean, it's like, you know, Minecraft's a lot like that as well. Unlike Dominion, though, those games are graspable. Mm-hmm. Like, well, maybe not Dwarf Fortress immediately. However... Minecraft is a lot more graspable than something like Dominions. I tried so hard to play those games.
Mm-hmm.
I really did, and I couldn't do it. I just could not do it. There's something about it. Like, I mean, Bruce Garrick really made me want to play those games.
Yeah.
And then I tried.
Mm-hmm. I remember like reading his tutorial for Dominions 2, and I still couldn't figure it out. And then he was hired to do the manual for Dominions 3, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, he was, actually. He did the manual for Dom 3, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a big difference between a game that's easy to learn and difficult to master versus a game that just has that complexity right from the start.
Yeah.
And there definitely is a sense of beauty for the games that can manage to ease the player in, but at the same time, it's next to impossible to do that design in a strategy game when you basically lay all the cards on the table from turn one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Strategy games are a tough nut anyway. Strategy games assume that you want to learn complexity, I think, a lot of times. I mean, a lot of the games are based on how realistic they can be, or how they model the way damage is done and the way that movement is taken into account, and flanking moves, and it's kind of a different world, but at the same time, it's, I don't know, I think it's possible to do it well. I just think most people don't really take that approach, and I think it's even seen as kind of a sign of weakness if they do.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody can have, you know, just that whole Talonsoft level of gaming where it's, you know, basically just a giant board game that the computer does the math for you.
Yeah. I think if we compare strategy games to the RPG genre, if you look at a lot of the older RPGs, early to mid-90s, they also had a huge learning curve. Like, if you try to play, like, one of the old Might and Magic games, or even, like, the original Baldur's Gate, and over the time, we've seen the RPG genre sort of smooth out those complexities.
Oh, yeah.
Which is both good and bad, in a way, because it opened up the genre to a lot more people, but then there's definitely, like, the fans who miss the days where you could really build these complex characters.
Yeah, and that's kind of like what, it's almost, it's like a Blizzard kind of thing, where mm-hmm. Blizzard is excellent at taking complex subject matter, capturing the essence of it, and kind of putting it to putting it back together in a much simpler and more digestible way, and that's really cool. But at the same time, you do kind of miss the nuts and bolts sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why I really like the Etrian Odyssey series, because mm-hmm. on one hand, they are easy to get into, like. There's a lot of complexity there, but it's not, like, hitting you over the head with it. But they also make it, you know, in terms of, like, graphic style and how they present everything, very easy to learn. So it's definitely, like, a more of a modernized take on, like, a lot of the older RPG genres.
Right.
Okay. All right. So let's move on and get to the topic of the week. And as I mentioned earlier, I want to talk more about this always-on connectivity that we're seeing both with the Microsoft new system and what has been trying to get, like, forced down our throats with, like, SimCity 5 and Diablo 3. Now, I know earlier you said that you were for it, and I'm going to be the contrarian in this case.
Oh, how good. Yeah, somebody needs to be.
Basically, I think always online is a fool's errand. And the reason is that I spent 2 years working at Comcast doing tech support. And I started out in internet. So basically every day I would get 10 to 12 calls about people with internet problems. Now, before then, I was, you know, your regular gamer. I had my modem hooked up, and outside of, you know, thunder, monsoon season, I had internet access. So I was always on, like, a lot of people. But during my time there, I learned quite a bit about how the general populace has their internet hooked up. And the fact of the matter is that the majority of this country is not built for reliable internet. And there are several reasons for that. First is simply by the fact of how houses are hooked up. If you look, when the cable company comes out to install for the first time, they basically run the wires as according to what that person is getting.
Right.
So if you live in a home that you were just getting TV access, they're just going to run the wires to, you know, where your TV hookups are and be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
If you then try, say, you know, down the line, I want to get internet access, you're going to either have to find some way to finagle that around, you know, where the cable line came in, or you're going to have them come out and run, you know, whole new lines. And that gets ridiculously expensive. I don't remember how much it was when I was working at Comcast, but I remember that was like one of the most expensive things to get done. And then there's issues with like living in cities, apartments, or basically any kind of multi-floor living arrangement.
Yeah.
That can be very difficult, because if you're running the lines from the street, you may only be able to get that modem, you know, like on the first floor of like a 4-story house.
Right.
So I've had people call in telling me issues that their modem is literally in the basement and their computer is, you know, on the 4th floor. And you can just guess how fun troubleshooting internet problems are in those situations. But the fact remains that the country at right now is not an always-on nation. There's plenty of areas, and as you said, like you know, in like Seattle or, you know, a major city, internet, you know, is all hooked up. But like for like people out in the country or in small towns, quite frankly, the internet access is not at that point where we can reliably say that everyone who has internet can use it reliably. And to complicate that matters, a console is different from a computer.
Sure.
And for a lot of us, we may not have our console in the same place as we have our computer or even our modem. They may be in 3 completely different areas of your house. So I think to expect that, you know, everyone's, you know, going to have perfect internet access, going to be easy to get to, is just such a misnomer.
Right.
And there's a piece this week or last week about someone saying, you know, how, you know, it's a good thing, you know, this is going to be great for everyone, and Microsoft will learn from the mistakes of EA. The problem with that argument, as I've said, is that you're looking at this from the point of the game designer, or from, you know, the other end of the connection. What about for, you know, the guy whose Xbox is, you know, in his den and his modem's in his attic? How is he going to be able to get that to work unless, you know, without spending, you know, hundreds of dollars, you know, rewiring his entire home?
Well, I think I like it with certain caveats. I mean, I just mean on average, I believe the average household is pretty much online. That will be into the latest Xbox. Now, however, I mean, there is always going to be issues with it. And I think it'll be foolish if they don't make certain concessions for that contingency.
Mm-hmm. And going to what we've seen in terms of games, Diablo, SimCity, and even Ubisoft,
mm-hmm.
there's definitely, like, once again, they're assuming too much. Now, to be fair with Microsoft, with EA, Blizzard, and Ubisoft, they had major issues on their end. We saw, you know, EA's infrastructure just broke down for that entire week of SimCity 5.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure the same thing happened with Diablo. Was it a week for Diablo, or was it more that took them to iron out those network issues?
It was a few days. It was close to a week, yeah, I would say. But I don't think it was an entire week. They were on it pretty fast.
Yeah.
It was, you know. Now, like the first night and like for a couple of days afterwards,
mm-hmm.
it was a little spotty, but they did get it figured out pretty good.
And with, like, those types of situations, I mean, I think one thing that's probably pissed off a lot of people this generation is how much control they've lost over their purchases.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we've seen, like, how, like, the user agreements, like, on an EA game, you're not buying a game anymore, you're buying a service. And for those of you who can't see right now, I just did the air quotes with that right there.
Right.
And I think that has annoyed a lot of people because basically they're losing a lot of their basic rights, but they're not getting anything in return. And that is a huge difference from what we've seen Steam has done with Valve. Valve has done with Steam. Let's just reverse that. And with Steam, they basically said, okay, you're going to have to be online to play these games. We know that sucks, so we're going to give you a unified friends list. You can chat, share everything, and if you, for a single-player game, once you download it, you can run Steam in offline mode. So if during those cases where you don't have internet, you can still play the games you already have downloaded.
Right. Yeah, and yeah, it just, it's kind of like a growing pain for what people are, you know, or for the way everything's going. You know, if you think about it, people hated Steam. Mm-hmm. A lot of people still probably do. At the beginning, everyone hated Steam.
Yeah, I know. I did. I actually, the first time I installed, I was like, oh my god, this is horrible. This will never last. And now look at us, you know, 5 years later, I have like 500 games on my Steam account.
Yeah. No, yeah, me too. You know, It's just a little crazy, but I think it's going to be one of those situations where that's the way it's going. However, I think we're still going to see plenty of physical media that you can play in your game box that you don't really have to be connected all the time for, just like we did in this generation. Microsoft isn't as ballsy as Valve is.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I heard a lot of people were commenting on was that if Microsoft decided to do this and make their system 100% online only, that they would basically be giving second place to Nintendo. Do you think that's true? Do you think that enough people would swear off of Microsoft to switch to Nintendo? Or do you think that things would basically sort of stay what they are right now?
I don't see people switching to Nintendo. Not the people that would purchase an Xbox. Don't get me wrong. I like the Wii U, but it's almost too late. They keep getting games pulled. There's not like a really strong thing going on here. Like they don't have like a big interesting release schedule.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. Like because like I said, I like the hardware. I like Lego City Undercover. I like. I like Zombie U. I think it's got a lot of potential, but it's roughly a little bit more powerful than what the Xbox 360.
It's around there, I believe. Yeah. It's supposed to be like comparable to what's out this generation.
Right, and you know that's cool and all, but I mean, what was it 7 years now? You know, it's almost a bit late. So, like, I think Nintendo's always going to be a member of what's going on. You know, I think they're always going to be there because they're always going to have the DS. They're always going to have Zelda. They're going to have Mario. And that's enough to move systems for them. But I think that, yeah, like I said, I think the people that buy Xbox 360s, I don't think the same appeal is there for them. Unless Nintendo comes out with some crazy something or other out of nowhere. I cannot imagine the 360 losing to Nintendo. I can see them losing it to Sony. But yeah, no. I mean, Nintendo's such a different market.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Nintendo has always, especially with, like, from GameCube on, they've always been the outlier, I think, of the console market. They have really great games like this. I think there's a lot of great talent working at Nintendo, but the problem is that one game or one series doesn't make an entire platform. I mean, I love, you know, Xenoblade Chronicles, I love Smash Brawlers for the Wii, but at the same time, I pretty much went, you know, 5-6 months in between game purchases for the Wii. And, I mean, with the...
That's a big problem they have in the U.S.
Yeah. Same thing with the GameCube. I mean, eventually it's got to the point that I was just basically, if I just owned the GameCube, I would just be sitting around for months and months on end waiting for something new.
That's what the Wii was for me, specifically. Yeah.
Now, another thing I remember some people were saying was that given how standardized, in a sense, major development has become, like whatever comes out for the PlayStation outside of exclusive will usually be out for the Xbox and for the PC. Some people were talking about how pretty much the only two things they would need would be a PC and whatever Nintendo system to basically get the blunt or the majority of the market. Which, I think that's somewhat accurate, but I think, once again, there are still a number of exclusive games for Microsoft and Sony that you would still be somewhat missing out.
Oh, sure. And that's really kind of the huge coup that Microsoft pulled with the 360 that I guess it's been kind of a while now, so it's not really the forefront, is that Grand Theft Auto was not a Microsoft franchise. Mm-hmm. A lot of that stuff wasn't. And Sony got... They took a couple of really strong hits with, like, releasing a console that was double the price of their competitors.
Mm-hmm.
Without any real first-party games outside of... exclusives outside of, what, like, Uncharted. Metal Gear has always been a Sony thing. And,
I guess we... First, we could have counted Demon's Souls with that, but now the series has moved on as now cross-platform.
Right, so Sony lost a lot of their exclusivity that they had over Nintendo and Sega because Sony became like the hip console for a long time. It was like the edgy one. And then they lost a lot of that appeal to Microsoft, which had a cheaper product. It just... I don't know. Sony was... I'm really interested to see what they're going to do this generation. We'll put it that way.
And I think Microsoft's exclusivity has been a lot stronger. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Halo, even like Call of Duty, which is a multi-platform at this point, is still... I think it's like one of the most popular games on Xbox Live still.
Well, there's one huge reason for that. So, I mean, that huge reason is that they get the map packs, like, a month or two before every other platform. Yeah. And I mean, if you look at, like, Bethesda's games, like, everything for Bethesda stuff is going to come out first on the 360. It just does. And then it'll come to the PC. It will always come to the PC. PlayStation, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, and I always thought that was weird. That, like, they have, like, a really... really weird history of updating stuff on the PlayStation. It's like, you know, a lot of the Fallout 3 stuff didn't come out, or if it did come out, it didn't come out for like a really long time. So it's kind of weird. I don't know if people had a harder time developing for the PlayStation 3, or they just didn't feel it was worth the trouble. I don't know.
I've heard like some reports of people saying that it was a little bit difficult to work with because I think they use a different kind of engine. It was like a Cell engine.
Oh, yes. They use the Cell processor, which is really awesome. And the whole like big thing about the Cell processor that makes it interesting in the first place is that they were going to try to release a console without having an onboard video card. Mm-hmm. They were going to use the Cell processor to do all the work of the video card, but they realized, kind of like at the last moment, they really couldn't pull it off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that just coupled with using a Blu-ray, which is cool, but having really crappy load times hurt them in that market as well. Sony was notoriously difficult to work with, but I think they're trying to change that around. And they need to. Obviously.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that like the whole thing with Steam, with the Steam box, do you think that's going to have like any major impact for this next generation?
You know, as much as I want to say yes, I don't think so, because I'm not sold on Steam box right now. I want to be, and it's not that I don't think that the guys at Valve can really pull it off. I think they can, but they had the weakest Linux launch. I think it was kind of sad. You know, Half-Life, not even Half-Life 2, you know. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that is just kind of like strange for your big thing. So hopefully they get it together and a whole bunch of cool stuff just like drops for Linux, and then I'll believe in the Steam box, cuz I think really to make it happen they're going to have to go with like a Linux distribution running it. Mhm. So I don't know. If they can get the graphic stuff worked out between OpenGL and DirectX, I think it's going to be a home run. But that's a tall order.
Yeah. Now, one thing I just forgot about with the Cell processor, I heard that that's also going to be a major detriment to backwards compatibility. I think they said that.
Of course.
I think PlayStation 4 is not going to be backwards compatible. Correct. With PlayStation 3.
Correct.
And I think that Microsoft hurts. said the same thing about, I think, Xbox 360 will not be, you won't be able to play that on the new system as well.
That doesn't really make any sense for them in a way, because I bet you it'll be easier to get 360 games to work than it will be to get Cell processor-based games to work. Because Microsoft's programming tools, I guarantee you, will probably not change that much from what they are currently, because people absolutely love the Microsoft Visual Studio stuff and like how streamlined it is for development. So if they keep like a similar architecture, they may be able, or like a library system, everything, they may be able to do some kind of quick porting or something like that. But yeah, that Cell processor, that's a problem. Sony's never been good with that backwards compatibility. I have one of the first run PlayStation 3, so you know I have a PlayStation and a PlayStation 2 built inside of my PlayStation 3. So that's how mine plays backwards compatible stuff, but they can't afford to put a Cell processor in there. I promise you that.
And to me, a backwards compatibility is a big deal, because I do like to return a lot of my older games.
Yeah,
I love how I can play GameCube games on the Wii. And even like the whole virtual console, when I first heard that concept of, I can now play Super Nintendo and regular Nintendo games on, that just, you know, blew me away.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's like, I think Sony's answer to that is going to be to keep converting stuff and doing stuff with like the Vita and you know, supporting the PlayStation Store. But I think they're pretty much going to pass it on to you. You know, there's no way that you're going to get out of this with some sort of like, oh, here's a copy of all your games code, because that's never going to happen for Sony.
And that actually takes us back to the concept of always-on connection. Right. Whenever we hear of, whenever, you know, developer announces their games will have always-on, you know, Diablo, SimCity, they always bring up the term that the game is really a service.
Yeah.
And how the online is supposed to be required by that. How do you feel about, like, them saying that games are more of a service these days than a product?
That's been like a little gray area for a long time. That's kind of like, I guess, I mean, people may not know this, but when you purchase a game, you do not purchase a game, you purchase a license to be able to play that game. So, like, they can come and, theoretically, they can do whatever they want with it. And that's, you know, and that's something that came up with that whole EA thing, when people were being banned from their accounts or what have you, and or from the forums and not being able to play their games anymore, that kind of thing. So it's it gets really sticky, you know. So people, it's I don't know. It gets into a weird legal area, and they're always trying to protect themselves naturally. And I don't know. Video gaming is, while it's been around for a good while now, it's still basically in its infancy. These are growing pains, I think, that a lot of things have had to take on historically, like movies and television and everything with VHS and different ways of distribution. But it's just going to take, I don't know. I don't even know how it'll shake out.
Yeah.
Yeah, who knows?
I think what really hurts it is when we have, you know, like hackers and modders who basically figure out that, hey, all the stuff they say, you know, is required is practically bullcrap. Like we saw it with SimCity 5, where someone, you know, just altered like one file slightly and they were able to play the game offline without any trouble.
Oh, yeah. Now, I mean, stuff like that is certainly, there's certainly a gimmick going on there. They want you online so they can advertise to you. They want you online so that you can feel connected to your friends and buy stuff to keep up with them. You know, it's just, it's certainly a gimmick. And it's a gimmick that I'm afraid a lot of people are going to learn a harsh lesson about. And apparently they haven't been paying attention because it's been going on for a while now. I mean, there's always some sort of fiasco with those online games. You know, I mean, Diablo 3 is almost like a Cinderella story compared to a lot of the other ones, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, people still dislike it and everything, but 99% of the time it works.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't feel like you're getting nickel and dimed, which I'm afraid is what EA pretty much wants to do.
Yeah. And if you look like on Amazon, there's still like almost, there's about 1,700 negative reviews for Diablo 3 for its online connectivity.
Yeah.
And then when you look up SimCity 5, it's right now at, it's just over 2,000 one-star reviews.
Wow. And that's been a lot less, it's been out a lot shorter time than Diablo. Good God.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a copy of SimCity now, and I know there's a big patch coming out next week, and I'm looking forward to playing with it. I think I'm just going to wait until next week and start then, because, man, I love SimCity. Those games are awesome.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know. It just seems like of all games, why would you make SimCity? I don't know. I guess I could see the appeal of being able to trade services with different towns and stuff like that. It's not necessary. It should be optional, you know.
Yeah,
I guess that's really what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's the big point, that it seems more like a marketing decision than it was an actual gameplay decision. And even then, I mean, we've heard reports of how like a lot of the aspects of the simulation are broken. So there's definitely more problems than just the always online.
Oh, sure. There's a lot of stuff. Like, and don't get me wrong, I think some of us are a touch nitpicky, but I know there's a bunch of broken animations and just weird stuff that goes on in the game. So, like, EA always releases stuff kind of half-baked, though. Or not always, but that's kind of a part of, like, gaming now, too, is that people just feel they can put whatever they want out and patch the crap out of it.
And the other issue with Always On is the matter on will the game remain available to play forever? Because we've seen in the past that EA is not, they're not above, you know, turning off game servers for a lot of their online games. And not even just like sports titles. They did with, you know, Battle for Middle Earth. So, like, when you have these games like that, where they basically just, you know, kill half the game, I mean, what's going to happen when, you know, if we transition to a point where single-player games have to have an always-on connectivity, and, you know, someone decides to turn off the server? Is that game basically, you know, lost in the ether at that point?
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's the problem. It's like, Tom's a huge fan of that RTS Middle Earth game. We talk about it all the time, and they have no problem shutting down those servers. Yeah, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, I don't know. It's just kind of so weird because aren't they also the company that sells like online passes for things? And if you purchase an online pass, it doesn't mean that your game's going to still be there.
Yeah, they have like Dead Space.
Yeah.
But then again, like everyone seems to be doing the online pass these days. I mean, BioShock Infinite has one. Borderlands, probably Saints Row had one. So, yeah. I mean, it's definitely become a popular advertising campaign.
Yeah, and the problem is like, if you sell that and then you shut down the online service for it, I don't know. There's just something to it. You can still play your game, in theory. But if it's kind of like a primarily competitive online game, it just kind of loses its steam. Because I know they did that with some of the MMA games and stuff like that. And I think some, I don't know, they're famous for kind of just saying, hey, whatever, shutting it down. They're very, very cold, calculating, and businesslike. And that's, I mean, that's what they have to be. They're EA, but it will never win them any fans.
Yeah, as evident by they were voted the worst company in America last week.
Which, I know Peter Moore responded to that. Mm-hmm. I kind of have to agree with Peter Moore that, really, voting EA the worst company in America? Honestly? Yeah. In America.
Yeah, I mean, they're bad, but they're not as bad as a lot of the other companies.
Right, we're not talking about Exxon. We're not talking about, you know, any of these, just countless companies that are worse than EA.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. That's just the power of the internet for you, you know? I mean, I guarantee if it was not a consumerist, like, online poll or whatever, and they asked people, like, actual call polling, it wouldn't be EA.
Yeah.
But since people on the internet that obsess about these kind of things, they can seriously sway any sort of online vote. Nah, it's just, yeah, I mean, EA kind of sucks and everything, but, I mean, until they've actually committed some sort of, like, horrible crimes against nature, I don't really consider them that bad. I don't know, they've released some shitty games, but not crime against nature yet.
Yeah. I think the problem, going back to the idea of games as service, is that right now, the games as service seems to be more for the people selling the game as opposed to the people who are playing the game.
Oh, yeah.
And I think if for this to exist and keep going, I think there definitely needs to be a huge change in the mindset of that. I mean, if you just look at Steam, really, it definitely is a form of DRM, but it has become so much more.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, you look at, like, SimCity or when, you know, Uplay first came about. I mean, that just, you know, pissed off a lot of people.
Yeah, Uplay is one of those things that I kind of like what they're going for, but I hate the execution of it.
Yeah.
It just kind of bothers me. But it's mostly just harmless. Origin's just kind of a sad joke. I just really wish they had just stuck with Steam for all their stuff. It just works better, and not everybody wants to have, like, 14 different online services running at the same time on their computer all the time. So, I don't know. It just... Origin, with very few exceptions, is always going to lose out to Steam for me.
I think the only, I guess, silver lining in how we have moved to a lot of these digital platforms is that we've gone away from a lot of, you know, the old, you know, Secure ROM, StarForce, copy protection, because the platforms themselves basically handle that end. So it's not as evil as it was, but it still is annoying in some cases.
Sure. No, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt. It's, I don't know, DRM is one of those things, too. Like, Ubisoft had a really hard time with it, and they've backed off of that a lot, which is smart for them. Anno even had some ridiculous protection stuff in it. But, it was like, a lot of the Anno stuff was always on stuff, though. But yeah, no, it's certainly something that needs to be worked out, and I'm always behind the idea that no matter how good your copy protection, it will be cracked. Mm-hmm. So why don't you have a little bit of faith in your customer base and, you know, make the game accessible without a huge pain in the ass to the people who actually pay it.
Yeah.
Pay for it, because the people that are stealing it are going to have it cracked, and they're not going to have to deal with all the crap.
Yeah, that's a good point. When it's easier to play the game by pirating it than it's actually give developers money, you know that's a big problem.
Right, and you know that's something that I think came up a lot in the late 90s, early 2000s, and beyond, was that people would get no CD cracks all the time.
Yeah.
Because, A, they usually made the game run faster. And B, nobody wants to keep a huge library of their CDs of games laying around, just in case they want to play it. And, you know, CD drives are irritating. Computers do stupid things. It was such a bad system overall that, yeah, it's kind of fallen a lot by the wayside, but it's been picked up by the whole internet connectivity thing, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, I think my last point, then, going back to the original matter of if we are going to, be able to reliably move to an always online world, I think in order for us to get that point, the actual internet service providers will have to step it up. Because as it stands right now, while, game developers can, wish and want and plan, the fact of the matter is they are basically held back by the state of the ISP market. I know Google has been, doing their Google Fiber, which I've heard, they're trying to make it, cheap and affordable internet for everyone, which sounds really amazing, but I have no idea, how that plan is coming along right now.
I think they recently put something in Austin, or they're going to, but I was reading something about it the other day, and it seems like it was maybe 150 or something, but bucks a month, but it's gigabit internet, that kind of thing. Of course, there's considerably lower levels, but gigabit ether or ethernet connection or internet connection certainly piqued my interest.
Yeah, I know. With Comcast, I think I'm in their triple play whatever bundle, but in terms of their internet, I think they're charging. I think last time I checked, I don't know what their going rates are, but I think it was $40 for 12 to 13 megabits, $50 or $60 for, 20, but that's still, nowhere near gigabit level.
Oh, no. I mean, I have a 100 megabit connection here, and it's pretty sweet, but, man, gigabit's 10 times faster. So, yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think the only way we're going to be able to get to that always-on world is when, gigabyte speeds, or even just megabyte speeds, or, down to, pennies instead of,
oh, yeah.
Tens of dollars or even hundreds of dollars. I know Comcast does have a gigabyte connection, but I think that's a $200 a month.
Yeah, it's $200 to $300, I know for sure. There's a few around, but they're kind of prohibitively expensive. Even though it's super fast, it's just...
Yeah.
And that's just kind of prohibitively expensive. I could see $100-something for a gigabit when it first comes out. But, all these services are dropping in price, too.
Yeah.
I pay $70-$80 for my 100 meg connection, which is expensive. But, it's nothing compared to what it used to be,
Yeah. I remember when I first got the Comcast service, and it was only a 5 or 10 megabit connection.
Yeah.
And then over time, that's improved to the point where I'm now at 22 at my same initial base price.
Right.
So, and that's because, technology has advanced, pricing has gone down, but I still don't think we're at the point where we can safely assume that, everyone who buys a console will have, perfectly reliable, fast internet as well.
And I think that's a big thing to consider as well, is I'm a high-tech kind of... I'm a super nerd. And so, I'll go out of my way to have that. I don't watch a lot of TV. I don't have TV running. I don't have phone running.
Yeah.
And those are two things that are going to sap the living bejesus out of your bandwidth. Like, yeah. HD is no joke. HD eats bandwidth. So, like, if you have a couple of HD TVs going and a phone going and everything, you're still going to have, you know, internet connection and everything, but your level degrades quickly.
And don't forget about just, like, the pricing as well, how much it's going to fall each month. I mean, like, Comcast, they charge, it's like $10 per additional digital box in your house. So if you're like a tech-savvy guy who has, you know, three or four HD TVs with, you know, plus three or four HD boxes, that can run you, you know, $40 a month right there in terms of equipment, and we're not even talking about, you know, cable service or anything like that.
Right, and, you know, most people are going to have their internet bundled with their cable or telephone, or both, and I just think, yeah, until we have faster internet speeds to compensate for everything that's going to be running at a reasonable price, then, and we're getting there, don't get me wrong, it's actually coming along really well. I don't think always on is super realistic for a console, but I think also that always on is a misnomer for that console. Of course, we won't know until it comes out, but I would be super surprised if you can't just play regular media on it as well.
Yeah, that's just going to be super ballsy if Mike Urkel says, you know, there's no way to put a CD in this console.
Yeah, I don't think that's not going to happen. I think that Best Buy, GameStop, all those places would have an absolute freaking heart attack. Well, not really Best Buy, because they don't really care that much. But like GameStop's going to have a problem if they do that.
Yeah.
A big one.
Yeah. And let's not forget, you know, every major game now has, you know, GameStop pre-order bonuses. So that's going to probably send a few people to jump out window, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You can't get too obsessive compulsive about those pre-order bonuses. I learned that.
Yeah. I guess last point then is, well, we talked about, I think what you mentioned earlier with how consoles are trying to become the media center of a household. I think that's another interesting point, because in that sense, they are trying to compete with cable providers.
Yes, very much so.
But then there's the flip side that they can't really compete, because how are you going to get the internet connection without, you know, dealing with the provider? Because, I mean, Comcast is huge for their cable and internet service.
Oh, yeah, sure, and absolutely.
So, I mean, it's really hard. So you're sort of like biting the hand that feeds you in a way.
Oh, I guarantee you that they'll get theirs. You know, you stop your subscription to cable, Microsoft takes it over. I'm sure Comcast is going to come in there somehow. You know, I'm sure of that. It's really the content providers and kind of it's companies like HBO that really kind of put a I don't know, kind of a stick in the old spokes of doing that, because they're so super protective of their own stuff, because they want to keep making physical media, and they still want to, you know, they want to, you know, charge $1 zillion per season, which is what HBO does, and they're not going to give up a giant piece of their profit without some sort of fight. So that's going to be the next big war, I think, for the next generation. Is Microsoft's going to move into the living room, and I think it's going to do well, but I think they're going to have to really, really bring a strong game when it comes to content.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, like the contract negotiation deals for these various channels can get pretty crazy. I remember there was a point where I think DirecTV was going to drop AMC.
Oh, yeah.
And I know that just, like, drove a lot of people crazy.
Who was it? It was, like, I think it was Time Warner that dropped Comedy Central for a while, which was just, like, a huge, huge issue for them. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if they realized it or not, but, like, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are super popular, as well as, like, South Park, stuff like that. It's just really bad. I don't know. It's nobody's going to win until they get that figured out. But I do think that's coming as well. I think the days of the giant cable provider providing actual television service are coming to an end, and we're going to see cable providers just providing internet service, you know, and phone.
That would be interesting to see, like with Microsoft, they had ESPN on there. It would be interesting to see, like, if, like, the consoles will, in a sense, become cable providers in their continuing transition to becoming that staple of the home.
Right, and you know, I think, and of course, I'm sure I'm not the person that came up with this initially, but I'm pretty sure that if Microsoft could sign something like where you pay like a couple of bucks a month for ESPN, they would make a mint.
Yeah.
You know, or if you could say, oh, I like Comedy Central. I know that I can buy all their episodes and stuff the day after, but like if I was to pay $5 a month and just be able to watch, you know, a stream of Comedy Central or even on demand stuff, yeah. You know, it would just be they would make a killing, and yeah. And I guarantee you that is something they're working on.
Yeah, I agree with you completely on that. The first provider or the first service that can get a la carte channel purchasing,
yep.
is going to be, you know, rich beyond belief.
And that's what I don't get about how much HBO protests, is I think that HBO would be one of the highest subscribed things if you could do a la carte, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't even think you can just, like, sign up for an HBO Go account and pay for it anymore. Or, you know, I think you actually have to have it through the cable provider, which is, I don't know, just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, and I think with at least with Comcast, I don't think you can just get HBO. You have to have
Cinemax
one of their,
or something. Yeah,
or at least one of their basic digital packages,
right.
Before you can add HBO on top of that.
Oh yeah, no, you have to have a basic cable package before they'll even talk to you about anything else. So yeah, no, I think we're going to see a lot of interesting stuff. Maybe not at release this winter, but I think 2014, 2015 will be pretty cool for like television and media in general.
Yeah, especially after, it wasn't last year, but the year before when we had the big move to digital, when we got rid of analog streams. So that's sort of starting things, but we haven't really seen like the full impact of that yet.
Yeah, no, not at all. It's going to be pretty cool though.
Yeah, but it's definitely going to be interesting. I mean, we've seen so much change, I think, over like the last decade in terms of, you know, have you ever thought, you know, back then we were going to reach this point where we were buying games digitally instead of going to the store?
No, you know, I mean, it's absolutely hard to believe. You know, that's been the story, I guess, for the last so long, as technology does kind of keep clipping along. Yeah, it's we've come a long way, you know, I mean, the 20th century for us was huge. We made these giant leaps, and it just keeps compounding and compounding. I mean, you know, we're not inventing flight or anything, but everything is becoming so much more sophisticated and nuanced.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at mobile technology, you know, blew up in the last decade with the release of smartphones, tablets, and the whole deal.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a huge market, and a lot of people are scrambling for it.
Yeah. And I think it's funny like how I was like one of those guys who really jumped onto the video game industry back in the 80s.
Yeah.
But like with cell phones, I'm still using, you know, like a two-decade-old cell phone. I don't even own a smartphone, so I'm like, you know, out of touch in that market.
Yeah, well, you're not missing all that much. I mean, you can still get most of the good stuff on PC.
Yeah. All right. So I guess final question for the podcast is, seeing as, you know, this decade we're still very young in it, as we talk about, you know, the future of digital, future of online, do you think by the end of the decade, do you think we'll see any major shakeups in terms of the console market?
You know, I almost want to say that this generation, I think we're going to lose one this generation. I think this is the last generation for one console, and I'm not sure who it is. But if I had to wager, I'd say Sony, if they don't do it right.
When you say this generation, do you mean like PlayStation 4, 7? Okay.
Yeah, yeah, the new Xbox and the new PlayStation and You know, honestly, it's either going to, if I had to guess, it's either going to be Sony or Nintendo. I mean, I think Nintendo will always be around in a limited handheld form, but I don't know how much longer they're going to stay in the console market if they just can't.
Yeah.
I don't know. They're always just one step behind for some reason.
Yeah, they definitely, in terms of their plans, they're definitely, I think, the most secretive of the three.
Oh, yeah. Because
you never really know what they're going to come out with next.
No, yeah, absolutely. They are a strange company, and I've always had a lot of respect for them, but they, yeah, they're very stubborn.
Yeah. I mean, last decade we saw, you know, the drop of Sega, which that shocked a lot of people, and they've somewhat managed to bounce back. They're not, you know, super popular, but they haven't, you know, gone out of business like a lot of the other companies.
Oh, sure. Yeah, they still do a good bit of, you know, publishing. They have, Company of Heroes. Didn't they pick up Company of Heroes? I know that they, have the Total War franchise, and all that stuff. Bayonetta.
Yeah.
And the horrible Sonic games, but that's another, that's another discussion.
Yeah. I think for me, I think my prediction for this decade is, I think we're going to see either a huge rise or a huge fall in terms of, like, AAA developments. You know, EA, 2K, in that general market. Because I think we're reaching that point that we're seeing a lot of huge development being done through the indies and smaller developers. And it seems that as the cost of AAA development continues to skyrocket, I think they're putting, I think, too much of their eggs in one basket with these games. I mean, you saw with Square Enix how they announced that even though Tomb Raider and Hitman did good, it didn't do enough to basically break even, or wasn't what they were expecting.
Yeah, that's a big problem.
So I think by the end of the day, I think we're going to probably see, I think, a few more of these major companies. I think they're going to fall. Although, I think we're going to see a lot of them going to fall, but I think there's still going to be one more super big one, I think, that's going to crash. Either, you know, either like an EA, 2K, or Activision.
Yeah, if I had to guess at any of those, I think Activision is, as they say, too big to fail. Because, I mean, they're also backed by Blizzard, which is kind of like a double punch. I don't think you're going to see EA go anywhere. Mm-hmm. The other's not as common, or not as easy to predict, I would say. 2K would be the one I would worry about the most, or Take-Two or whatever, just because, I don't know, just because you're dealing with some cool games, but they've had some historical difficulties. I mean, you know, if you look at, like, the Duke Nukem's fiasco, many years of Duke Nukem fiascos.
Yeah.
You know, they have some stuff going for them, but, you know, Rockstar can't keep you afloat forever.
Yeah, and Rock Band, I think, I don't know if we're going to see another one of those for a long time, considering the cost of development making them.
Which is, you know, in my opinion, is a real shame. I'm a big fan of those games, but I understand. You know, I mean, I still have Rock Band, and that means I'll always keep my PS3 around. Because I ended up getting it on PS3 because when it came out, you couldn't find the freaking thing anywhere. So I just bought the first one I could find. and I got, like, tons of songs and stuff on it. So, you know, it's a shame that we'll never see another one. But they did such a good job with, like, Rock Band 3 that there really doesn't need to be another one for a good while.
Yeah. All right. I think we can end it there.
All right.
All right. So, we're going to call it here, everyone. I'd like to thank Jason for being my co-host this week.
Oh, thank you.
And you are, of course, always welcome back. Mm. Hopefully, we can have more people on. I know next week, if Ken manages to come back to us, we should have a big discussion on BioShock Infinite that time.
Oh, yeah, nice.
And
I'm interested, is Ken finishing BioShock Infinite?
Mm-hmm. We had, like, a huge, like, or at the beginning of the week, we basically had, like, an hour-long argument, like, just, like, typing back and forth as we were debating over BioShock Infinite. This was like at 3 o'clock in the morning, too. So it was just like us like arguing with each other.
Yeah, no, that sounds about right. Yeah.
And as always, for those of you listening, if you would like to write for Game Wisdom or be a future podcast guest, feel free to send us an email. You can click on the Submissions Wanted link, and we would love to hear from you. And that will do it for us. So, from the Perceptive Podcast, thanks for listening, and I will talk to you next week.
Have a good one.
Take care.